I'm very sorry about the picture I'm going to paint for you today. But I'm very sure of it. It doesn't all start out bad. We're talking about Jolene Van Alstyne. Apparently, her body is racked in pain. And she is a resident of Saskatchewan, Canada, and they wouldn't treat her. So she applied to enter the Medical Assistance in Dying program, where a physician or nurse practitioner can be enlisted to kill you. And she was scheduled to be killed in January of next year. She requires surgery. So Glenn Beck took the bull by the horns on that one. He's saving her from making a understandable and awful decision at the same time. She needs surgery, and thanks to Glenn Beck, she's going to get it. He has a Tampa area hospital standing by, and if successful, the surgery and treatments will improve Van Alstyne's life and health. And she's only 30. She's 30 years old. She has a very rare condition called neurofibromatosis type 2. Very painful disease. Had it for 8 years. Per her own report, her affliction has isolated her, and Canadian healthcare has failed her. And desperation drove her to choose assisted suicide. Let's start painting the picture. In Canada right now today, what they're paying to service the debt is more than they're paying for the Canada Health Transfer. They're paying $76.1 billion to service the debt, and the Canada Health Transfer is getting $65 billion. Now, this is going to cause interest payments to surpass the combined payments for the health care and the child care, which they also have, guaranteed child care. This is because the Trudeau and Carney governments are sort of spendthrift. What does that sound like to you with our $38 trillion in debt? Now, currently, Mr. Carney has priorities other than his citizens' health care. Government-run healthcare pledged ease of access, timely care, and quality service, and they have struck out. But let's start painting the picture. So if you have government-guaranteed healthcare, which is what they're trying to have here, then that's only as good as long as the government can afford it. Which right now, the United States government can't afford to take you to coffee. And we have 13 states now, I think, in the United States that also have a medically assisted assistance in dying. Illinois just became the latest one. Now, in Canada, what we're seeing with their already established socialized medicine is delays and long waits and denials. And that's not just for rare conditions. In 2025, physicians across Canada reported a median wait time of 28.6 weeks between a referral from a GP and receipt of treatment, down from 30 weeks in 2024. So, 7 months to see a general practitioner. For a routine concern. And there's a backlog of 1.4 million medical procedures across Canada's 10 provinces. So, I'm telling you this to give you context. Because if we were to ever get it nationwide here, they would certainly fumble it. They would run out of money. They would start saying, we have to cut something, and you would almost certainly be thrown to the wolves on that one. Everybody that's in Obamacare right now, you would be thrown to the wolves on that one. And then what? What if you're like young Miss Van Alstyne here? She's got this thing that just hurts all the time, and you can't get any treatment for it at all. And you decide, you know what? It'd be better for me just to be dead. I'm just that desperate. I just don't want to hurt this much anymore. So the government in Canada, without good options, the system they put in place funneled her to assisted suicide, and MAID became her last resort. And that's a safety value for a resource-starved system. Assisted suicide in Canada is the fifth highest cause of death. And it looked just like this. Canadian National Healthcare required Van Alstyne to seek a referral for surgery from a specialist in Saskatchewan. Fair. The kicker is that in-province specialists are no longer taking new patients. Their patient loads are full. Since there are no surgeons in Saskatchewan capable of performing the operation, then this would have to be referred for out-of-province care. And who knows what wait lists look like for surgery in other provinces. And then, you know, you got to deal with bureaucrats being bureaucrats and politicians being politicians. And they're all going to talk around this particular dilemma. They'll say it's an outlier. They'll say that no system is perfect. Are you claiming that U.S. healthcare doesn't have problems already? They'll counter. Now, see what I do. I have found a doctor, and there's more than that, more than one of these out there, I'm sure. But I found a doctor that isn't affiliated with either of the systems here in town. I could call him today and see him today and get treatment today if I needed to. But this is you know, this whole death with dignity thing, this was all designed. This is another one of these little psyops. And in Canada, it's a disposal system. Van Alstyne isn't terminally ill. And she does have treatment options. She didn't want to die. Surgery will give her a pretty good shot. Killing her under the circumstances, that's not compassionate. That's her falling victim to a failing system. Right now in Canada, 4% of people who are approved for assisted suicide did not have a terminal diagnosis or reasonably foreseeable death. Nearly 23% reported isolation or loneliness as a reason for seeking euthanasia. Medical practitioners reported that 50% of the people requested it because of being a perceived burden on family, friends, or caregivers. You know, in Illinois, it's all about, you know, these are for the terminal people that want to die with dignity. Yeah. G.K. Chesterton, he said this, men do not differ much about what things they will call evils. They differ enormously about what evils they will call excusable. Sorry about that. But that is the picture I see coming out. Now, thankfully, it does not look like our president is willing for any of us to die for European tyranny. This is News Talk 98.9 WORD. All right. In the 80s, well, I mean, after World War II, we started, NATO came about. And I don't remember what year it was. It might have been 48. And that was to be a buttress against the USSR on the European landmass, which we had just spent a whole lot of time trying to, keep it liberated. And sometimes we didn't make it, but in the end we won out. So what we did was we started NATO. Now, along with that came this whole idea that you guys are not really going to, you're not really going to, you know, do too much against us, are you? Now the European Commission has levied a several hundred million dollar fine on Elon Musk and his social media platform X earlier this month. So right now, today, as we stand here, you, me, everybody in the United States, everybody serving over there is currently, they're all serving and they're supporting censorship and state-sponsored propaganda. Michael Schellenberger, journalist Michael Schellenberger, actual real journalist, he accused the commission of engaging in a deception campaign aimed at confusing Europeans and American into thinking that European elite's goal is anything other than to censor the American people. He also pointed out that the fine came while European governments were demanding backdoor access to all private text messages under the pretense of combating the transmission of child pornography and creating a so-called democracy shield of government-funded fact-checkers that enables censorship by proxy. He also noted the European Commission announced the fine to coincide with the rollout of the Trump administration's new national security strategy, in which Trump makes this promise: we will oppose elite-driven, anti-democratic restrictions on core liberties in Europe, the Anglosphere, and the rest of the democratic world, especially among our allies. So, Schellenberger put two and two together, and he made a very interesting observation. The EU is now in direct violation of the NATO treaty, which requires member states to have free speech and free and fair elections. France and Germany are actively and illegally preventing political candidates from running for office for ideological reasons, namely their opposition to mass migration. And the Romanian High Court, with the support of the European Commission, nullified election results under the thin and unproven pretext of Russian interference after a nationalist and populist presidential candidate won. And as a parting shot, he yelled at him, "Hey, everyone has the right to freedom of expression. This right shall include freedom to hold opinions and to receive and impart information and ideas without interference by public authority." Now, at this particular moment, what's going on with the European Commission is they're pretending to defend their own charter while they're seeking to eradicate the free exchange of ideas on X, censoring your speech, spy on citizens' private text messages, and create an army of government-funded NGOs to justify censorship and push the commission's propaganda. Schellenberger points out that, J.D. Vance, he got out there, he said, "Germany's entire defense is subsidized by the American taxpayer. There are thousands upon thousands of American troops in Germany today. Do you think that the American taxpayer is going to stand for that if you get thrown in jail in Germany for posting a mean tweet?" And Vance has warned them, do not have shared values if you're jailing people for saying that we should close down our own border or canceling elections because you don't like the result. And that happened in Romania. You do not have shared values if you're so afraid of your own people that you silence them and shut them up. And they should heed J.D. Vance, because he is a leading candidate for the American presidency in 2028. And then Schellenberger, he's a very preeminent journalist. They're both warning the European bureaucrats that their activities are threatening the foundations of the Western Alliance. And, I mean... I mean, it's for those of us that have been there and lived it. And listen, duty in Germany was not bad at all. But it was 3 years away from your family and everything you know. And I was a very young person. I volunteered to do every one of those things. But now I'm sitting back and I'm finding out that all these things I did have gotten them to the point to where they are now. Now, while Trump's out there trying to put together a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine, there are rumors on the continent that the European Commission is threatening behind closed doors to sell $2.34 trillion in U.S. Treasury holdings that should we impose an unsatisfactory peace settlement or outright withdraw military and financial support from Ukraine. And that would trigger a financial crash more severe than occurred in 2008. Now, the fact that our allies that we have propped up with gigantic kickstands over the past, seven decades would consider destabilizing the global economy in order to prolong a war on the European continent says a whole lot about the priorities of the old world. You got tens of millions of illegal immigrants erasing Western civilization. You got the green energy insanity that dooms the economies there. You've got the aristocratic elites insisting on censorship and government-approved propaganda and perpetual war. Brussels and London and Paris and Berlin are so committed to total war with Russia that they will sacrifice every last Ukrainian and outlaw peace. Better to remain a master over the dominion of poverty and division and bloodshed than to permit non-globalist political parties to win elections. Now, the problem is that they're not ready to fight their own battles. But that's a story for another time. Because This one's got legs. It's going to keep on going. With the Republican Party, the future is not the old guard. This is News Talk 98.9 WORD. You know, there's a lot of people in the Republican Party that would like to see it go back to pre-Trump time. And that's just not going to be unwound. But still, they try to propagandize you to believe it. Like a new Manhattan Institute survey, which claims that the future of the right lies with traditional Republicans. Which I don't know about you, but that's terrifying. This shouldn't count as a revelation that the average Republican is in a based social media poster. But it's obvious that it's something that many people consider. But the point being made by the Manhattan Institute is not simply that the offline right is very different from what you would see on X. It's that the ordinary Republican voters want the old GOP back. And the purpose of contrasting ordinary Republicans with the extremes of the online right is to revive the lame conservatism that Trump defeated in his primary battles. They're making they identify two large blocks of GOP voters. One is the core Republican, which apparently makes up 65% of the GOP electorate. The other is the new entrant Republicans, a group compromising 29% of the coalition. But the problem is that, you know, while I get the whole thing about what, you know, and most of the core GOP voters are exactly like I am. They're conservative on economic and foreign policy and social issues. But they favor lower taxes. They take a hawkish view of China, remain firmly pro-Israel, and they're highly skeptical of progressive agendas. Now, the problem that the new entrants have is because they're basically a bunch of Democrats that just crossed on over. They still come here with some support of left-leaning economic policy, right? They're more critical, more favorable towards China, more critical towards Israel. But at the same time, it's who is going to step up Who's going to step up and hold it together like Trump's held it together? Now, I see the problems coming from the new entrants. I understand that. And at the same time, I also see the status quo, not from the core Republican voter. They're good to go. I'm good with them. But at the same time, the people they vote for are not exactly go-getters, are they? And some of the new entrants are not as committed to the old GOP as the old GOP voters want them to be, the core GOP voters. Now, recently, there was an article put out in the City Journal, and it was put out by a guy named Jesse Arm, and it appears to think the battle for the GOP is just between traditional Republicans and Nick Fuentes. And he mocks the idea that the Fuentes fan, which he describes as a 20-something male Zoomer, still living at home and spending a lot of money on a lot of time online and spending a lot of money on video games and pot and porn. He mocks the idea that that's the future of the party. And he conflates this caricature with the new entrants to argue for the superiority of the core Republicans. And he says the loudest voices in the right-wing attention economy speak to, and for a particular segment, younger men, often non-religious, often alienated from institutions, steeped in internet-fueled irony and grievance. Our survey suggests that they are numerous enough to matter, but they're not the median Republican voter. The coalition's beating heart remains the normie Republican Washington keeps forgetting. Older, more church-going, more hawkish, more pro-Israel, and uninterested in burning the country down. But it's curious that the core feature of ordinary Republicans is that they're hawkish. They want neoconservatism. They don't want conservatism. And they imagine it's what the base wants, which that's not the picture. I mean, neoconservatism was John McCain. And this isn't even, they're not even reading the room. Right, they're not even reading the room correctly. Republicans are less hawkish now than they were during the George W. Bush era. Right now, a plurality of Republicans either want to cut or entirely eliminate funding for Ukraine. By comparison, a majority of Democrats want to increase funding for Ukraine. Republicans are less likely now to back NATO and other international commitments. They're not as concerned or greatly concerned with foreign affairs as think tankers are. And the average core Republican that Arm idolizes may not be an isolationist, but he's likely to have questions about our relationship with Israel and NATO and Ukraine. But those matters also don't animate regular voters as much as they do the pundits and the analysts who obsess over foreign policy for a living. That's always been true. But it's not just the foreign policy of the old guard that that analysts like Arm want to restore. Everything about Trumpism has to be put out to pasture. And Arm is implying that the future GOP should jettison the new voters Trump brought in favor of other demographics. But I don't know what you win with neoconservatism. There's not a great demand for the return of Paul Ryan or Jeb Bush. The entire GOP has been Trumpified to a great degree as well, which makes me take their little study that they've got out and say to myself, I'm not even sure that's valid. Not even sure that's valid. So, what we have here is MAGA versus the old guard. And Republicans love MAGA and the new GOP it has created. That's what I see. So they've chosen here to frame the 20-something loser addicted to porn versus normal people argument. Like young men are all, every young man out there today is this way. That makes it an easier choice for you to sit there and say, oh, well, I must be part of the core Republicans. But you're not. You're MAGA. It's okay to be MAGA. I kind of like being MAGA. Gives me direction. Gives me direction, and it gives me purpose. But, you know, they're out there publishing that nonsense. We're going to go back for a quick second just to touch on the whole pain management thing, since that's one way they're killing people all across the world right now today. This is News Talk 98.9 WORD. The government. You can have a perfectly good thing going on right there, and all of a sudden the government's going to step in and make it so much more gooder, and it just goes in the toilet. When I was a kid, for those of you that may have lived in Columbia back in the day, my doctor was Dr. Guy Castles, who later on became the head of the South Carolina Medical Association, I think. And Dr. Castles was left pretty much alone. Nobody's walking in there to tell him what to do. And everything that he ever diagnosed on me always seemed to get better. But, you know, the thing here is that doctors are service providers, and we're paying them for a service. So when we go to them and we pay them for a service, why should the government get in between us and them? Right now, there's millions of Americans with chronic pain that are being denied effective treatment options, and then they have to either just take the pain or go somewhere else to get these opioids, and then they're going to get addicted or dead. Because then they're going to get something that's fentanyl-laced, right? So, and I've said this many times, government, once again, has failed us. 80 million Americans a year are prescribed medication for acute pain. And they are for opioids, half of those, where unintentional misuse is easy and abuse is often easier. In 2023, 8.6 million Americans reported they misused prescription opioids. But it's estimated that over 200 people died from an opioid overdose every day in 2022. So for chronic pain patients, the odds are not that much in their favor when they're forced to take the gamble. But the FDA is responsible for protecting patients through the regulation of these drugs. And that comes with this responsibility to test and approve new drugs, which the FDA falls short on. In the best of circumstances, it takes anywhere from 10 to 15 years for a drug to reach the market. And then when it finally does reach the market, after all that testing and analysis, the price is through the roof. R&D is always going to be a lengthy process, but the FDA is responsible for years of unnecessary delays that keep life-saving medicine out of the hands of the patients who need that. And patients in the United States are routinely unable to access medications in safe use in other similar countries because the FDA is constantly falling behind on its own approval process. It's absolutely nonsensical. Right. If you're unfortunate enough to become one of the millions of patients a year who do get addicted to prescribed opioids, this same government will make it difficult for you to receive treatment for opioid use disorder. If the opioid addiction turns into criminal activity, as it so often does, they will lend their hand once more to incarcerate you. So they won't help you until they take you off the street. But then, you got a new bunkmate named Killer. And it's a very depressing cycle because most people don't pay attention to what they're being prescribed. And it's a clear example of why the government shouldn't have full control over the medical and drug system. Now, opioids are still widely used, but that's not to say access to opioid pain medication should be centrally restricted because they are needed. And they're appropriate for some patients, but they're not the right fit for every pain patient. But in January 2025, to not very much fanfare as I noticed, the FDA did something. They approved a non-opioid painkiller. Jurnavax, developed to offer patients an alternative to opioids in the treatment of moderate to severe acute pain. And what makes this better than opioids? Well, the trial showed no signs of addiction risk. So, we do have a lifeline to chronic pain patients all around the world, but it doesn't change the barriers that they have built for the millions of these patients who are already addicted to opioids. Why wouldn't we just, I don't know. Why wouldn't we just let the doctor make the decision? Aren't doctors regulated to their eye sockets? I think they're regulated to their eye sockets. But anyway, I think it's time for the government to start playing doctor. But now, if this were in Canada and they were denying them opioids to treat their pain, these people would probably, they'd probably be applying for medical assistance in dying, which is horrible. Think about some kid who's in a motorcycle accident or something, spinal, and he's in pain all the time, and he can't get anything for the pain because we just can't prescribe opioids for this. And he's in his 20s, and he's in Canada instead of here, and because nobody will prescribe him anything, he just says, you know what? I just want to die. And then you got a 20-something-year-old guy who has a pain injury, and instead of treating it, they just kill him. I'm being asked on the text line, what's the name of the non-opioid drug? Jurnavax. J-O-U-R-N-A-V-X. Jurnavax. Jurnavax. It's Jurnavax, as in journalist. Jurnavax. So look into that. Now you have a choice. Now you have a choice. This weekend is a massive operation that has been made so easy and so successful. It's called Goodfellas. You've heard me talk about it. Joining me from American Legion Post 3 will be Rich Cochran. This is News Talk 98.9 WORD.